Good evening, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to react to Slavs and Tatars. I gave my reflections the title, The Politics of Time, Crimea as a Meeting Place of the Past, the Present, and the Future. Time is an underappreciated factor in political analysis. The politics of time denotes more than just the start and end point of an event, a process, or a cycle. Instead, it revolves around contested claims about legacies from the past, political agendas of the present, and visions for the future. The present engages simultaneously with the past and looks to the future. The present rewrites history through a selective process of remembering and forgetting, and thereby seeks to legitimate current and future state and nation-building processes. Different aspects of temporality structure our understanding of the world around us. We're aware of notions of timing, of duration, acceleration, tempo, and we differentiate between rapid versus gradual and short-term versus long-term change. My own discipline, political science, speaks of path dependency, a concept that posits that the order of events matters and becomes more important over time. It struggles to disentangle the causal role of legacies. It tries to understand the consequences of a certain sequencing of policies. It pays attention to critical junctures which disrupt and reconfigure familiar patterns. And it specializes in generalizations based on data collected at regular intervals. There are many parallels in our everyday use of temporal reference points. Time primarily appears as a tool to contextualize, to compare, and to emphasize, rather than as the central subject of inquiry. How do different conceptions of time exist in parallel, overlap, clash, or shift? What are the mechanisms through which the past inscribes itself into the present? My discussion of these issues starts from a space and a theme that figure prominently in the lecture by Slavs and Tatars. The space is the peninsula of Crimea, and a theme is the relationship between the self and the other, with their inherent attempts at classification. The paradox is that while the self and the other are employed as frames that create and reinforce difference and thereby help self-identification, the categories themselves are in flux, and the other at one point in time can be an essential part of the definition of the self at a later stage. Crimea is an interesting example of the construction of identities based on a wide range of parallel, overlapping, and contested memories and images inspired by its location, landscape, and population, and transmitted through maps, toponymy, travelogues, legends, literature, and art. The time frame here clearly reaches further back than the 100 years now. The boundaries of Crimea as a cultural space are difficult to draw. History has continuously been rewritten, and Russian and Soviet histories have been dominant, but they have been challenged by the Crimean Tatars and the Ukrainian state, among others. When the Russian Empire expanded southwards in the 18th century, Crimea, with its Tatar and Ottoman legacy, was perceived as something different, even exotic. But by the late 19th century, it had already been appropriated as an integral part of the self. In the Soviet period, Crimea was redefined as an important component part of the Soviet self. And in the post-Soviet period, since 1991, it has occupied an ambivalent position between a new other, independent Ukraine, and the self in Russian national identity. In 2014, a moment of political upheaval in Ukraine tipped this ambivalence into a strong revival of the idea of Crimea as a defining element of Russia's self. At the time of the annexation of Crimea by Russia in March 2014, Crimea was not an other, but very much a self located within an other, Ukraine. And that other was threatening to increase its cultural and political distance from Russia in the aftermath of mass protests and the ouster of then President Viktor Yanukovych. There are certain moments when temporality is compressed and the past, present, and future appear more closely intertwined than in ordinary times. Often these moments are moments of domestic and international crisis, or both. The occupation and annexation of Crimea by Russia in 2014 constitutes one such moment characterized by the close proximity of past, present, and future. Moments like these disrupt the logic of the present. Phenomena that were prematurely relegated to the past can resurface, among them manifestations of the power of nationalism or the fragility of international legal norms. The moment then becomes a window onto different temporal layers of political claims and identities. For our analysis, it usefully widens the time horizon, but it also comes with the risk of reaching for yet another linear narrative that promises to reduce complexity in the heat of that moment. Just as definitions of the self and the other evolve over time, there is no universal perception of time itself. Time is inherently political. Which historical events are deemed significant for what historical narrative is a choice made through filtering and selecting. This process comes with its inbuilt objectives and biases. In these temporal hierarchies, historical events are shortcuts and lenses onto larger processes, for example, the construction of national state identities. In the case of Crimea, at least three national temporal perspectives overlap and clash. Russians prioritized the imperial conquest of the peninsula in 1783, the battles over Sevastopol and the Crimean War and the Second World War, the unrightful transfer of Crimea to the Ukrainian SSR in 1954, and the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 that turned the peninsula into a region in a neighboring state. The Crimean Tatars view their national homeland, Crimea, primarily through one dramatic event, their deportation by Stalin in 1944 and their return since the late 1980s. The Ukrainian state perspective centers on 1954 as a pragmatic and legitimate border change, which Kiev has invested in since, and on 91 as the belated recognition of an independent Ukrainian state. Each narrative highlights different elements of Crimea's history. The Russian nationalist narrative projects the continuity of a Russian Crimea from the age of Catherine the Great to the present, while ignoring Crimea's preceding centuries as an independent Crimean Tatar Khanate and as a part of the Ottoman Empire. The deportation of the Crimean Tatars under Stalin also remains outside mainstream Russian imaginations of Crimea. And the transfer of Crimea to the jurisdiction of the Ukrainian SSR under Khrushchev in 1954 is not accepted as a legal basis for Crimea's post-Soviet belonging to an independent Ukraine. Crimea as a setting of repeated large-scale national defeat has been reappropriated into a Russian narrative about national glory and resistance, symbolized by the two sieges of the city of Sevastopol during the Crimean War and the Second World War. Today, Crimea is everything but the other in the Russian mindset. This streamlined identity project, pursued even more vigorously by Russian elites in Moscow than in Crimea, blanks out Crimea's lived reality, including the complexity of the past inscribed into the ethnic makeup of the regional population, the peninsula's toponymical landscape, and its place in literary and popular imagination. The myth of Crimea in the Russian imagination began as an elitist imperial exotica with this journey of Empress Catherine II in March 1787 through the newly conquered southern provinces of the Russian Empire. Catherine II and her companions, Joseph II of Austria, alongside French, English, and German counts and envoys, were spared any evidence of disorder and unrest thanks to Grigory Potemkin's adept stage managing of the tour. They encountered seemingly happy, well-fed peasants en route, the so-called Potemkin villages, and in Crimea they met peaceful Tatars who swore allegiance to the Russian state. Contemporaries interpreted the tour as a demonstration of the grandeur of Russian imperial power, but it was also the beginning of the Russian romance with the peninsula, its jewel in the crown. In the 19th century, this tradition was continued with the Crimean Riviera being the luxurious playground of the Russian and European literati and wealthy elites. In Soviet ideology and popular imagination, the peninsula was proletarianized as a zone of working-class tourism, symbolized by the Crimean pioneer camps and sanatoria where the Soviet Union holidayed and Soviet elites retired. The collapse of the Soviet Union tore apart the cultural and historical map created by Russian imperialism and Soviet ideology. Crimea now found itself outside the Russian Federation, a shock of dislocation which reverberated widely across Russian political elites and society at large. Interestingly, many of Crimea's natural features retained their Crimean Tatar names even during the Tsarist and Soviet periods. Parallel Russian or Hellenistic names creating continuity with Byzantine Greek influences, for example, the best-known two cities, Simferopol and Sevastopol, and translations of Crimean Tatar names were introduced, but in public and literary imaginations, they never fully replaced the Tatar names. Inside Crimea, there is, to borrow an evocative term coined by the Nigerian writer Chimamanda Adichie, no single story of Crimea. Not all the memories and identities attached to Crimea are mutually exclusive and conflict-prone. They are shaped by a general recognition of Crimea's multi-ethnicity and a collective identification of all main ethnic groups with Crimea's landscape, location, and natural beauty. A shared imagining of the region provides ample raw material for rival claims during political mobilization in times of uncertainty, but it can also underpin the attempts to accommodate diversity. Surveys of the Crimean population and its political elites have repeatedly demonstrated the relevance of the self-identification as Crimean, Krymchanin, within and across ethnic groups, and multi-ethnicity is the most frequently highlighted characteristic of the region. According to the 2001 census in Ukraine, just under 60% of the regional population were Russian, just under 25% Ukrainian, and about 12% Crimean Tatar. The figures have changed since the annexation by Russia last year. As Benedict Anderson has described in his book Imagined Communities, the census, alongside the map and the museum, is a very powerful tool of control and identity construction. In the case of Crimea, data on the ethnic breakdown of the region suggests clear categories where, in fact, the ethnic background of ethnic Russians or ethnic Ukrainians is often mixed. The same holds for the eastern regions of Ukraine embroiled in war at the moment, where already 7,000 to 8,000 people have died and about 2.5 million people have been displaced. Ukraine tends to be portrayed as a country split into east and west, along ethno-linguistic lines. And the war has reinforced this misconception of the Ukrainian state. Similarly, the annexation of Crimea has inadvertently led to a widespread tacit recognition of Russia's historical claim to the region. Here, the dangers of accepting a new, or not so new, single story in the midst of a crisis become apparent. A prominent example of a shared regional storytelling shall suffice to illustrate the notion of Crimea as a multi-ethnic cultural space. Among the most widely known and most often told legends are those connected with distinctive rock formations along the southern shore of Crimea. In particular, the legends about the Ayudag, the bear mountain near Gurzuf. Tatar legend tells us that the bear was sent by Allah to punish and destroy the unruly inhabitants of the shores. When he took too long to finish the task, Allah turned him into stone as he knelt down to drink some water. And a more romantic version describes a stranded girl reared and treasured by the bears inhabiting the island. When she falls in love with a young man washed ashore and decides to flee, the bear starts drinking the seawater in order to pull their boat back to land. The beautiful voice of the singing girl makes them stop, and one bear is turned into stone. Depending on the version of the story, either by the sound of the girl's voice as a result of Allah's punishment, or because he remains in the same position watching his beloved girl disappear. And even a dominant cultural and temporal perspective can have unintended consequences. The Russian writer and poet Sergei Pushkin spent only a few weeks in Crimea on his way to the Caucasus, but the work inspired by his stay has become a powerful reference point in Russian and European literary imagination. In his poetic cycle, Tavrida, he refers to the happiest minutes of his life in Crimea. He evokes the image of a distant and magical region. For Pushkin, there is no doubt about Crimea being Russian land. The Crimean Tatars, their lives and gardens, form a picturesque background. It is precisely this romanticized, seemingly apolitical image that has come to dominate the Russian view of Crimea. One of Pushkin's best-known poems commemorates the legendary fountain in the Khan's palace in Bakhchisarai, Bakhchisaraysky Fontan. The Khan's palace appears to have survived Stalinist destruction because Stalin liked the poem, and perhaps indirectly because of its central role for Russian nationalism. The poem tells the story of the Khan Girai and his love for a Polish Christian woman he brought to his palace. When one of his jealous wives kills her, he erects an ever-weeping fountain of white stone decorated with roses. This became a Russian and Polish literary topos and tourist destination that blends a supposedly Turkic image of romance and violence into the tamed other. These literary references became building blocks of Russian imperial identity, but they also preserved references to Crimean Tatar legacies in Russian, Soviet, and Western imagination. Crimea as a multi-ethnic region combines an inherent potential for conflict with scope for conflict prevention. This apparent contradiction is illustrated by the difference between the political events in Crimea in the 1990s and 2014. From the fall of the USSR in 1991 to 2014, Crimea was seen as a rare example of non-conflict among the cluster of post-Soviet territorial conflicts. The potential for conflict in Crimea in the 1990s revolved around its unclear status within the newly independent Ukrainian state, its post-Soviet relations with the former imperial center Moscow, in particular the uncertainty over the fleet bases in Sevastopol, and the tension between the cultural and political domination of the ethnic Russian and Russian-speaking majority of the region and the Crimean Tatars returning from their places of deportation. Even in Western perception and media discourse, the likelihood of a violent conflict in the 1990s loomed large. Elsewhere, I have emphasized the process of institution-making, a lengthy process of elite bargaining over autonomy, rather than the actual autonomy status resulting from this process as a critical factor in conflict prevention in the 1990s. Russia's initial policy under President Yeltsin was to deter Russian nationalism in Crimea in favor of good bilateral relations with the Ukrainian state, whose foreign policy zigzagged between Russia and the West. By late 2013, Russian policy under President Putin was reconfigured to mobilize this same nationalism leading to the annexation of Crimea. The main difference was that by 2013, Putin had abandoned his predecessor's pretensions of integration with Western states around a rule-oriented international order. The domestic political conditions in Ukraine, the Maidan protests, and the resulting regime change and pro-Western tilt of the new Ukrainian government were the trigger for Putin to instrumentalize the power of nationalism. Let me draw this to a conclusion. Focusing on one particular space, Crimea, and one extreme moment, the annexation by Russia in 2014, allows us to think different temporal perspectives at once, and thereby question static classifications of self and other, and the linearity of national imaginings of culture, history, and politics. For at least a moment, the politics of time crystallizes into something tangible, but the risk of imposing a similarly misleading linear narrative onto this moment is also high. Thank you.